Hi, welcome to the Spotlight Report. I'm your host, Logan Graves. This is a monthly podcast where we dive into topics that pique our interest. They typically cover optics and science, but honestly, they can be quite broad. You can find out more about the Spotlight Report and find all of our episodes, as well as comment or like the podcast, on our new location, which is on the ELE Optics Community Forum. That location is community.eleoptics.com, and you'll find the Spotlight Report there. Thanks for listening.
So it started with, hi, this is a Spotlight Report?
Sure.
Okay.
So this week I'm speaking with Dr. Pearl John. Pearl received her master's in holography from the Royal College of Arts, and she has completed quite a significant amount of further education and accolades, but most recently she received her doctorate in art and holography from De Montfort University. And I might have, as I said, butchered the pronunciation of that.
That's perfect.
Well, but like I was saying before, I'm really excited about this one. I work with holograms for testing, and I always think that kind of the application of holograms, but light in general, towards art is a kind of not often discussed topic. So I'd like to just hear, how did you get into the field? How did you get into art first and foremost, and then holography beyond that?
Well, it's a pleasure to be interviewed by you, firstly. So I come from a family of artists. So my grandmother was a painter who exhibited in the Royal Academy. So it was already an acceptable occupational career when I came along. And I thoroughly enjoyed art at school and knew I wanted to be an artist from when I was a teenager. But I saw my first hologram when I was about 14, 15. And I sort of fell in love with holography the moment I saw my first hologram, which was in a shop window. It was advertising a holography gallery in Covent Garden, London. And I just walked past the shop window, and out of the corner of my eye, saw this beautiful, brilliant transmission hologram, so a rainbow hologram that appeared to be projecting into the space of the viewer, mm-hmm. you know, out of the window into the pavement on the sidewalk, and I was just captivated. So it was that sense of wonder and intrigue which just caught my attention, and I knew that that was what I wanted to do. As an artist, I didn't yet know what I was trying to say with my artwork, but I from that moment on, I knew how I wanted to say it. Mm-hmm. And a question you'd asked me in the preparatory discussion was about optics. Where did my interest in optics come from? And I have a difficulty in throwing things away that intrigue me. And I've actually got one of my first little lenticulars, which was out of a cereal packet. It's Merlin. It's a Disney with Merlin is waving his magic wand, and books are going into his bag or coming out of his bag, depending on which way you manipulate it. And then this was mind-blowing as a child, a Viewmaster. So just the one, again, that wonder and intrigue of how is this animation caught, or how am I suddenly in a 3D world, just transported through light and optics. So these are this prepared me for falling in love at 15, but I guess my fascination was probably from 3 or 4 onwards. Anytime I saw lenticular or Viewmaster, I was just captivated.
I have a vivid memory of being, I don't know, probably similar, three or four, somewhere in that range. And my uncle had one of the kaleidoscopes, right? And it wasn't until you said this, but that it popped into my head of, you know, you hold it up and you're immediately in like a different universe, and it's just full of colors and shapes. And I don't know. So it's a fond memory that I had forgotten about. So, but I think that's really interesting. Typically, and this could just be my naivety, but typically when I think about art, you know, most of what people might imagine is drawing, painting, or maybe photography, or maybe music. And I think that being drawn towards the medium of holography, it's super fascinating. And you're right. It kind of feels like a portal. Like I said, I deal with these pretty often. And every time you look through it, it's like, wow, you know, what am I seeing? So you said that you were kind of captured by it pretty early on, but I think the actual scope and message, at least what I've read of your artwork, is pretty unique. So can you share how you discovered what it was that you wanted to say and what that is with your artwork?
Well, I very much influenced by photography. My mother was a prolific family photographer. Sadly, she passed away. My father passed away quite recently, and I've been left with a collection of about 5,000 family photos to go through. And although this is personal, looking through family albums is a pretty almost universal or a familiar thing for us all. So I'm fascinated in capturing time through both the medium of photography and holography. I think holography enables us to have that extra dimension, which links so well with memory. That extra dimension really, literally and figuratively, gives a space for capturing time, along with the effect of the emotional impact that holography gives us. Mm-hmm. So my practice it goes in two different directions. I'm embedded in the Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of Southampton. So I'm surrounded by physics and astronomy and the work of the research work. And I often find myself wanting to respond to that work. So most recently I did work around black hole research, I'm particularly fascinated by the things that astronomers won't easily show you. So that their actual research processes. If I say to an astronomer, show me your latest work, show me your graphs, very, very reluctant to do so, even though I don't get the same information from what I'm looking at and what the researcher is looking at. Mm. We're looking at two different things. I'm fascinated by the process, but the researcher goes, oh no, there's a problem with this graph. You know, I'll show you my published work, but this isn't ready. And which always amuses me, because I'm looking at something very different to what they're looking at. Mm-hmm. The means of their research. I'm fascinated with the methods. So yes, two different directions. When I'm at work, I'm fascinated by the science, but in my own practice, I am very much fascinated by the documentation of family life that photography, physical photography, afforded us. Now that things have gone digital, I'm not quite sure where that leads us yet in terms of passing on historical documents. I think so many people's photographs are going to be lost because of not passing on their passwords, for example. So whole, whole collections of photographs may disappear digitally.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah.
It's It's interesting you say that. I'm sorry as well for your loss of your mother. My grandmother passed away recently, and it's a slightly similar scenario in the sense that there's thousands of pictures in the basement. And it's not digital, so they're not lost in the same way, right? Like we know where they are, but there's so many pictures, and you can go through them and they can be just amazing to look through, but it can also be overwhelming to have to look through so many. So it's, I don't know, an interesting scenario. Do you mind explaining more? I do really want to touch on kind of that human side of what you capture with your art, but do you mind explaining a little bit more, what you're capturing when you're working with these professors or astronomers, and kind of like with your work on the black holes, for example?
Yes, certainly. When I'm working with scientists, I am interested in the graphic representation of the work that they that their the research work. So, an astronomer will grasp a great deal of meaning from light curves, or and there is a whole world of information that I don't quite have access to because of the way that they can interpret the mathematical information that they're gathering. And so I'm interested in information that almost communicates but doesn't. Sort of a there's a space between what the scientist is doing and me as a communicator. There's a crossover, but I'm still losing a lot of information. So my role at Southampton in the physics department is science communicator, and I really am an artist with an arts background, although knowing a lot about light and photonics. So there are there's a communication, a translation process that I have to go through, asking lots and lots of questions, and the scientists being, or astronomers being willing to meet me halfway. So it's what does what do these graphs mean? What are they telling me as well as the scientist? And sometimes the graphs are communicating an emotional impact. So this is not a scientific approach. This is I love it when a scientist is getting very excited about their work, about something that I can see. And this graph is a signal, sorry, a signal of their excitement and their curiosity and their wonder. So it's a visual transmission of what they go through with their work, not just what the scientific information is telling us, but a communication between them and me when we're discussing it.
It's funny. I guess I have more exposure to physicists in particular amongst kind of the science field, but I think you hit it spot on that you can speak to them, and they're so much bundled up in their head and in their work, and they've been so immersed in it. And there are unique times where, I've spoken to professors or students where they can point to the graph and say, this inflection point right here, everything changed. And you can see how emotional they are, hopefully excited or, in a positive sense. Although I've seen the opposite as well of, oh no, the measurement went bad right here. And it, I think that's really important. I think it's underappreciated, that there's a human side behind the science, and there's humans doing it, and there's emotions wrapped up in it, and it can be hard to really capture, I think, really for any age people, but well, maybe I'll just keep it at any age of person, that there's a real excitement and ups and downs involved in this otherwise pretty dry sounding work and math and whatnot. So I think that's wonderful. So what about the family side of it? One of the things that really blew me away, and now I really want to seek out a gallery when I have a chance, if I'm ever in Southampton. But one of the pieces that you have on your website is, I want to say it's Mother with Necklace or something similar to that. I might get the name wrong, so I apologize. But can you kind of tell me a little bit more about how you capture kind of the human and family side of things?
Yes, it's aunt. An image of my aunt who was an actress, and it's a it's a hologram of a 1950s sort of screenshot of an actress, and she's wearing in a photograph black and white. She's wearing a distinctive necklace, in the I exhibit the hologram with its a reflection hologram that I have made transparent. And the actual necklace is exhibited behind it. And the connection between the object and the necklace and the image of the necklace superimposed emphasizes impermanence, a sense of loss. The person has gone, the time was captured, but it's with the transparent nature of the hologram, there is an ephemeral element to it. And it has quite a big impact on some people, because everybody's lost something, and it's clearly about the nature of mortality and us trying to hold on to a moment in time through photography, and mm-hmm. and again in holography, the volume of a hologram. Working in that extra dimension allows me to work in a bit of a timeless space. So it's about that acknowledging the loss and the ephemeral nature of trying to hold on to something that can't be held on to. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like holding onto water or sand dripping through your fingers when you take lots and lots of family photos. Mm-hmm. And I was particularly saddened that that we took all these photographs, or there are all these photographs, but it's always difficult to find the time and the space to actually look through them and remember all the actually acknowledge the body of work that you have, so that you're I think like you said about your collection of photographs, they kind of end up in the basement, sort of dipped into occasionally, but they're precious as objects as well as what's recorded on the actual photograph. But the tactile nature of the image as it's passed down has preciousness about it.
Yeah, and I it's interesting because I should say we'll share links when I post this, and we'll definitely share a link to your website, and there's an image of that hologram or that piece of art on your website. But and it is, at least for me, it was very arresting when I first saw it. But it is really interesting how, like you're saying, I mean, photographs, when they're taken, not always, but they're often taken capturing a pretty important moment, whether it's a lot of emotion or an important, unique time in life. And you know, you're trying to freeze that, you're trying to remember it, and you'll look at it. And sometimes And same with these photos. Sometimes when I was a kid, my parents would pull out some photos and say, "Oh, you know, this is from this time, or this is when you're a little kid and did something cute or not cute. You know, you caused a big mess, something like that." But otherwise, they kind of just sit in the attic or sit in the basement, and it is interesting to think about that, of how much how powerful of a thing they can be, and how not consistently brought out they are, I suppose. And it seems like we're almost accelerating with this, you know, certainly with cell phones. We take even more photos. And then, at least for me, I don't know about other people, but by and large, we really don't look at them. Sometimes Google or Facebook tells us, "Oh, you have a memory. Here's 8 years ago or something." And it can be really nice, but I do think that we're missing out on a lot of the photos that we've taken. But anyways, that's kind of an aside where I'm mostly rambling. So,
I know it's an area of fascination for me too.
yeah. So how do you make these? How do you make these holograms? 'Cause that's certainly not trivial.
I have two processes that I'm involved with. The first one is I make that pretty simple reflection holograms. So I have a photographic image, and I transfer that. I actually make a photograph onto a piece of holographic film, but just by printing an image onto acetate and illuminating a piece of holographic film with the acetate on top. And just like it's a photographic process of printing a holographic mask. Then I take that transparent image, which is either got sort of black and white. It's I can also do this with lithography, but I choose to make transparent photographs. And then I shine a laser beam, spread laser beam through that photographic image onto a holographic plate. So I have light coming from two directions, light straight from the laser as a reference beam, and light that has passed through the photographic image that's transparent. So I get that interference pattern that is captured on the holographic film or plate. So it's a one-step reflection process. Many art holograms require a master and then a transfer, but mine's just a one shot, and I'm working like this. And then I can color. I can choose the color from the of the final image. So that's I have a small lab or studio in the physics department, which I'm very grateful for. So can make that kind of, they're called shadowgram, reflection shadowgram holograms. So that's the first process. And the second process that I've been involved with is digital animated holography. That involves scanning family photographs and placing them in a virtual space in cinema 3D or Studio Max, and then I can put animations in a virtual space as well onto objects. And one of the holograms, Passing Time, Distant Memory, has a short film that is played on one of the objects within that virtual space. So the holograms are printed by Geola over in Lithuania. So they end up as animated by the viewer. As you move to and fro in front of the hologram, you animate the image. What I was interested in there is using the volume of holographic space to represent different time periods. So the further back in the farther back in the plate, the further back in time.
And so as the viewer kind of shifts the angle that they're looking at it, they're going to see a different portion of the animation or a different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm. So it's very much an interactive medium, digital animated holography, which is a fascinating performance that you set up. You first of all have to produce the image in virtual space using your computer software, but then you rely on the observer that becomes a participant in the artwork. So it's only their movement that creates the artwork, which is a fascinating and new element. I mean, there's always been an element of interaction. You see the holographic dance when somebody sees a hologram for the first time. And the idea, I like the idea of an emotional response to artwork, and the motion is a physical movement. So that sense of intrigue actually physically moves you. So you move around an object to see that it's three-dimensional.
Hmm. Yeah, I really like, kind of like you had said at the outset, and again, I have this every time that I look through. We place our holograms in front of an interferometer, and you see kind of the laser beam reflected off into infinity, right? So for people who haven't seen or aren't recently familiar with the hologram, the thing that I'm describing, you can kind of imagine like the mirror boxes, right? Or if you have two mirrors and you see it reflected to infinity, and it feels like it feels like a dimension, right? It feels like this place that you could go. And so I haven't seen it. I'd love to visit or see this piece, but that feels so tangible, right? That already your brain's telling you this is somewhere you can go. And now as you're walking around, you're kind of moving through it. It seems like it would be incredibly engaging. I guess there's two questions. There's a bunch of questions I want to ask, but one of them is, how hard is that process to make this animated hologram? It pulls on a bunch of different domains of knowledge. So
for me, it's a real struggle to use the software because it's a very, very different process than sitting in the darkened room of a holography lab, which is really hands-on, and has a wonderful atmosphere to it. You know, you're in the dark with a twinkling. For me, it's red laser beams in the dust, dust. But that has a almost like meditative, spiritual, your quality. You're actually in a wonderful space. Whereas when you're working on the computer, I guess I find myself in hyper focus. You know, hours and hours can go by as you're tweaking things and involving yourself in this virtual world. And it's not a natural one to me. So I've been grateful for other holographers' help with navigating this software. And it's the kind of software that animators use for professional videos like Toy Story, and incredibly, potentially incredibly sophisticated. So it is a new tool to be working with.
Does it impact maybe the ease to find the proper mental state, I suppose, to kind of deliver the emotional content that you're trying to deliver? What you said really resonates with me. When I work on a computer all day, which I have to do a bunch of, it puts me in a funny head state, and one that I don't necessarily love, versus working on things with my hands. You get It just feels different. And I can imagine it'd be really hard to deliver a particular emotional message, depending on which of those head states you're in, I suppose.
So I think there is, I'm sure there's a space, there's always spaces for happy accidents, because when you get the print of the hologram back, it's always going to be slightly different from what you intended. But I think, yeah, trial and error. It's just a different medium to work with. I'm suddenly thinking of the beautiful artwork of Isabel Azevedo, who works primarily with digital animated holography. And her work still for me has tremendous sort of emotional impact. She doesn't tend to work physically. So no, it's I think it's in it's what you see and what you imagine, and then getting that into reality still has effective impact.
So I do want to move on and touch upon your work in education, but before I do that, if we can spend a little bit more time here, I'm curious, I guess twofold. I think, again, for a lot of people in the sciences, at least that I've run into, there's maybe an underappreciation of art, and whatever that might mean. It took me until pretty late on in life to have a moment where I went to a museum and I was looking at a piece of art, and it hit me finally. Oh my God, like it literally hits you, right? And from then on, I've switched from being the type of person who, when you're in a city, would say like, I don't want to go to a museum. There's so many other things to see, to seeking out, oh, we need to go to this museum. My wife and I were in Paris, and there's a lot of museums, obviously, and they all had very long wait lines. So we snuck into the photography museum, which was mind-blowing. I mean, like, there was a piece, I'm gonna forget her name, but an exhibition of a person who had done some of the original, or very, she'd done work in the 1800s on portraitures, and it was primarily driven by photographing her friends and family, but trying to capture the image of the Virgin Mary and of kind of Cherubesque children and saintly figures. And
Do you remember her name? Do you remember her name?
I can look it up. Let me look it up, because I was just there. But I guess part of it is that it really, I think it captures a whole side of the human experience that isn't that's totally missed for me with science. And math. And so this is, again, I apologize, a rambling question, but do you have any suggestions for how people should discover art and whatever medium that might be, or not only how they should, but why they should? And I'll look her up while you're answering as well.
Right. I guess I'm wondering, I've forgotten her name, but I'm wondering whether it's the early photographer who worked in the Isle of Wight at Dimbola Lodge.
That sounds pretty familiar.
Right. Yes. So how and why? I had this conversation once on a long airplane flight with a friend who is an optics a physicist. Background in optics, and it took me 10 hours. so we were heading for a conference, an SPIE conference. So the how is, I think, as you've said, I think you can wander through museums or exhibitions, you can rush through them actually until something stops you dead in your tracks and has an emotional impact on you, and then you care. The why, I mean, there are lots of so many reasons for being involved with the arts and valuing personal expression, and you know, even down to the fact that in terms of industry, the creative industries are massive on a just for business purposes. You know, they're so a very valuable part of our economy. If you want to be really dry about it, let's look at just money and finances and say actually, and for one thing that I'm interested, if we make that connection between art education and science, there are very much, I'm very interested in STEAM workshops. You know, that's STEM, which is science, technology, and engineering, and maths. But adding a creative element to it enables children who are children of all ages who are more creative and would describe themselves as more arty, having science, technology, and art workshops and activities to do together enables access or makes the science more accessible to people who are more confident in the arts. So it probably goes both ways, that that art and technology would give scientists perhaps a more that the art becomes more accessible because it is through technology or based on science. So there are, I'm fascinated in that middle ground between art and science. Mm-hmm. But the emotional impact of science and art's the same. I do think that the way that I can inspire people to get involved with science and particularly photonics is through the emotional impact that it has on them. So wonder, intrigue, fun, these are things that stay with people. And these aren't dry things. You know, I'm sure that I'd be interested in your wife's story of what took her to maths. You know, there's you're drawn in and fascinated, and it's the emotional impact that enables us to stick with the you know, the more logical or the rational part of it. It's never just one thing or the other, I think.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting, and I'm not going to speak for my wife, but she entered, she arrived at math education not intentionally. Let me phrase it like that. She was kind of placed in math education, and through the years really developed a love for it, and particularly for math, which I think she otherwise might have not had as much at the outset. So I do always find that concept of, I can speak for myself. I felt the same way about optics. When I first started optics, it was strictly hard and unpleasant. And then now I think it's fantastic. Like, I love it, but that took a really long time. And I do think that maybe, I don't know, I'm not quite as familiar with it, but I do think that maybe that concept in STEAM of kind of finding the creative and emotional impact is a key part of it. So finding that discovery, that that fun, and just kind of ways to express yourself inside it, like you said, an otherwise pretty strictly rational and logical field, makes it worthwhile. Otherwise, we're not robots. You know, why are you doing it? So, but let's change gears a little bit. And I think that this is roughly on topic, but you spend a lot of time as well in outreach for optics. Sorry, my cat's trying to join the call. So you spend a lot of time in outreach for optics. Can you tell me a little bit more about what you do there and how you do so?
Yeah, sure. So my current role is doing outreach with an emphasis on photonics for the physics and astronomy department. And I've been there at the University of Southampton for 20 years. And when I started, there was a concern that there weren't enough physics students, that the national interest in studying physics was dropping, and physics departments were under threat of closure. In fact, one local physics department had closed. There's also a teaching shortage, a national shortage of physics teachers, which is a serious problem. And we're now up to much more healthy numbers. There's been we're part of a regional network of universities, all of whom have an outreach officer in physics in the department. And Southampton has always been very supportive of outreach. We actually have myself and a colleague. She does, Dr. Sadie Jones does astronomy outreach. So we have a traveling planetarium. I run a traveling laser show based on photonics, as well as doing hands-on optics workshops and a number of other activities with students and with teachers and the general public. I've just started a new role as outreach for the Cornerstone Centre at the University of Southampton, which is a silicon photonics prototyping centre that links academic research with industry. So I'm lucky that we have such a strong centre for photonics and optics. And I got into outreach and teaching as a result of any time you show somebody a hologram, if they've not seen one before, it's like, how did you make that? How does that work then? So you have to develop your 30-second, 3-minute, 3-hour or 3-week explanation of holograms, depending on the interest level of the person that you're talking to and time availability. But I took a course in training for artists in schools and ended up making holograms in school cupboards with art departments and science departments linking them and their students to with residencies. And from that, spent a wonderful 5 years in Columbia, Missouri, on a vocational program that was sponsored by 3M because they had a shortage of laser technicians, which I think is still the case in lots of places. So we trained up a lot of high school kids to who ended up in the local college, doing associate's degrees to become laser technicians. So, but I was allowed to teach whatever I wanted. So we did art installations, making bridges out of laser beams across the whole classroom, doing laser light shows, holograms. It was delightful. It was a real adventure. But then felt the need to come back to the UK and ended up in Southampton. So.
And so it sounds like a lot of your outreach, but certainly perhaps not all of it, focus more on, at least in the US, I mean, high school age kids. Is that generally kind of the case?
Absolutely. I'd say I specialize in working with sort of 15, 16-year-olds. However, I have written an undergraduate module for called Art and Physics: Experiments in Light and Color. So hoping to trial that in the not too distant future, where it's a transdisciplinary course that takes art students and physics students, or art and science more widely, and gets them solving problems together. Very much learning about each other's discipline and benefiting from the collaboration. So
It's funny. It's funny you said your length of pitch. You know, for how holograms are made. I went into my wife's classroom when she was teaching during during her first year, and we had brought, you know, demos. I was at the College of Optics, or the Wyant College of Optics, I think it's now called. So they had these little demo kits, and I want to kind of ask you about in more detail what your material is when you're kind of doing this outreach with students. But at the time, what we had is three different colored light bulbs. You can do kind of color mixing, and I think we had one of those great little demos of the three laser beams and various lenses kind of chopped in half, so you can see kind of where the laser goes. And I thought, this is going to be great. You know, the kids will love it. Maybe they'll ask some interesting questions. And pretty early on, I said, so what do you guys know about optics? Do you have any questions about it? And the first question was, this is some years ago now, but the first question was, how did they make the Tupac hologram? I think I don't know what it was. I don't know if it was a Super Bowl or some large event. And it was one of those moments where I thought, how do you answer this? You know, because I can really tell you how they make it. I don't think that's what you want, but I don't know. And I was caught fully flat-footed. Like, I didn't have a good answer. So, but I think that's part of the fun of it is children in particular, or you know, up through kind of high school age, they have so much, they approach it in a really innocent way, which I think can explore some really interesting questions. And they can come at it not so steeped in the field and here's the questions we really should be asking, but like, how do you do this cool thing? And otherwise, at least for me, I took it for granted. Oh, it's a hologram, you know, of course, but for them, and I think for most people, this is incredible. So what you mentioned a little bit, but what do you tend to show to these students that really captures them?
Sometimes I will talk about the difference between different media. So what's the difference between a lenticular? What do I mean by hologram? And what does the term hologram mean in terms of the Tupac hologram, which is Pepper's ghost technology? So the word hologram has very much been co-opted. Certain holographers I know call it phonography, the Pepper's ghost, you know, the projection thing. And and people have always wanted holography to be able to be the Princess Leia projected image. They want, I used to work for holography consultants, and people would regularly call up and say, look, I want a hologram of myself projected into the middle of the room from my television. And I've got about £60 or 60, you know, $80 to do it. You know, can you help? So there will always be, I've heard somebody say, I can't remember who said this, that holography, the kind of holograms that I make, will perhaps never do what, you know, the general public want it to do. But it's been a really good technology, enabling technology for other technologies to, you know, take up the baton. And how do we get this ghost floating, this angel or this ghost floating in our personal space? And how do we do that without having to pay too much money for it? It depends what age group that I'm working with, what the, you know, why am I talking to them? Now, it has been a case that we have wanted to educate people about the word photonics. So, at least 60% of adults in the UK have never heard of the word. So we aim to say, well, this is the photonics industry, and it's terribly important, and nobody knows what it is. And how can you invest it or trust an industry when you don't understand what the word photonics means? Some of my favorite workshops have been as a result of European collaborations, outreach collaborations that I've had that have been funded by EU grants, which have focused on us producing creative workshops. It's called Fab Labs that we work with. And the idea was to put creative activities in makers' labs. So there was an MIT spin out of Fab Labs, FAB. We're doing Fab Labs, PHAB. So all across Europe, there are these spin out makers' labs that are open to the general public for tinkering and making things and learning about different technologies. So our aim was to put creative workshops in these spaces, making sure that they would appeal as much to to all genders, you know. So it's not just for boys. One of my favorite ones is drawings on transparent Perspex boards that you slot into LED. Little LED stage, so that the children learn about soldering, about basic electronics, about programming, about optics with total internal reflection, actually illuminating the drawings that they've done, and to actually teach them some valuable skills. And I was pretty shocked to learn when working with European colleagues that UK students are actually sort of behind, because they don't get soldering, they don't get electronics experienced to the same extent as our EU collaborators. So learning all these skills and gaining confidence in them and showing them how they relate to current other technologies that they work in has been really, really enjoyable thing. So I could give you links to Fab Lab workshops. So those are kits that you can purchase or assemble for yourself to do some making. But otherwise, I mass produce holograms in lessons. I say mass produce. I can make 15 to 20 holograms in an hour and a half by setting up. Yeah.
That's a lot. That's mass production in my mind. So
I remember being terribly proud and pleased with myself for having made about 300 holograms in a year. And then meeting Portuguese colleagues from Aveiro University and Fabrica, where they have their own makerspace and science center on campus, and learning that they made 3,000 holograms a year with the general public, having this beautiful system where they could go into shopping malls and just work with groups of the public, called children, just mass producing holograms and getting people really excited about holography. So there are some superb educators out there. So you can get kits from Intergraph. I've got a colour holography kit from Litty. I'm not sure whether they're making those or not, but mass production is possible, but it's a matter of it's a matter of logistics, getting children to be quiet for the 20 seconds in which you have to do the exhibit, you know, the exposure to make sure you don't get any movement in the room. It's a bit more of a logistical, okay, you four stand over there and illuminate that hologram, go. But they usually, and I'd say 99% of the kids will get a hologram at the end of it.
Oh, yeah, that sounds amazing. And as I said earlier, we'll definitely post links to the fab kit and some of the other materials that you've mentioned. And I guess part of the stated goal, I think, often of these outreach programs, not perhaps the ones that you are doing, or let me phrase this differently. I'm not trying to say that this is the stated goal of yours, but some of the other outreach programs I have heard of, the stated goal is very much to kind of create a bridge from you're in high school and like everyone else. I don't know that we ever have high schoolers listening to this. I met one high schooler who did listen to this podcast, actually, which kind of blew my mind. But no, as far as I know, nobody knows what they want to do. Or if they say they know what they want to do, I'm always a little bit skeptical. And so it seems like these outreach programs really make a bridge towards, something that otherwise sounds totally out there, like optics and photonics. I don't know what that is. Maybe you're missaying phonics. I don't know. Or lasers. It just like I don't even know what that means. It creates this bridge to, it's a real thing, and you can work in it. In industry or as a creative pursuit or in a lot of different ways. And it's not out of reach. I guess, is that a fair statement for part of the goal of these programs?
The certainly when I look back at the it was called the Columbia Career Center, which was set up in the vocational school to get students into the local college to become lathe technicians and then go on to actually work in industry. Absolutely, it was successful. And it was accessible enough that we used to have kids coming in telling us that they were the brother or sister of somebody else who'd also go through the program. And it was a very clear, demarked progression. It was like, here's the industry at the end of it that needs the workers. Here's what you're going to do at 15 and 16, 17. So it was a 3-year program. And then you can go on to university or you can go on to do an associate degree. I had one kid ring me up and saying, I've just got my first job and I'm earning more than you, Miss John.
Perfect. Just be one here.
Be off with you. It was clear. Where they were ending up was clear, and there was a comfort in that. And I wouldn't still be employed after 20 years if I knew that it didn't work for the university. I mean, I had a 15-year-old come do work experience with me, and it was a bit of a trial by fire because the first day we hit the ground running, and he was having to demonstrate optics experiments to primary school kids. But we had such fun. I mean, it's exhausting doing outreach. And we dealt with 300 or 400 kids, and he was flattened by the end of the day. And him and I, there were two of the outreach or the team doing outreach. And he then helped me with the laser light show during his 2 weeks. And that was it. I'd actually got him on that first day because of the amount of fun that we'd had. So he came back to study physics as an undergraduate, where he continued to get paid by me to do outreach, stayed on as a postgraduate, and he's now working in industry. But it was day one hooked. So when you're part of that, when you're part of that system of children, and you can see where you're going to go, and you're enjoying yourself, and you're fascinated, then it works. It's a hook.
Yeah, and I think it's underappreciated by most people how prevalent optics are in everything. I hate to use the constant phrase, but optics really are in everything. And that means that almost anything you're interested in, you could go into optics and work in that if you wanted.
Yeah, absolutely.
And at least for me, I also want to add, just as a caveat, that for myself, the original appeal of optics for studying it was terrible reason. I was really fortunate and got to speak with Dr. Wyant when he was the dean of the College of Optics. And he told me, you make a lot of money and you travel a bunch. And I was hooked. That was all that I needed. I was studying biomedical stuff at the time, and I thought biomed's the coolest thing, but this sounds pretty good. And I think in hindsight, the component of optics that really has fascinated me is it provides, it's not the tangible things, but more so the fact that it really provides this bridge between like theoretical physics and math and the real world. It feels like you're working in this very ethereal thing and that's somehow connected. So I don't know if that appeals to anyone listening, but for me, that ended up being my reason of like, this is the greatest. I love working in this area.
I had to be a little bit careful the way that I sell working in, you're saying optics, I usually say photonics, because I remember doing a laser show at a school with very underprivileged kids in it. And I was waxing lyrical about the adventurous life that I'd had, which, you can go and live in another country. And I got these sort of disinterested, glazed look back. And what I realized I was sort of promoting very middle class values for me. Whereas the kids that I was talking to, that's not their value system. They want to be living opposite from their parents and just down the road from their grandparents, and so to zoom off to live in America was not a good selling point for them. But, locally, when I was able to say, you could get a good job, really good job locally, and it if you get this level of these exams, you can do this in photonics and optics. If you stay on to university and get this level, you could be doing this. Now, there's entry points at all different levels that you want to go in that will, it's good job, good prospect, good maternity leave. These were different selling points from a different audience.
Yeah,
But
no,
learned the hard way.
I think that's a fantastic point that, the other side of this is, and you did mention it, but the other side of it is there's a enormous unmet demand for people to work in the photonics and optics field, at any level, right? So literally at any level, from kind of hands-on technician all the way through doing things where you're spending all your time on a computer. And it can be, I guess part of it is, in a very real scenario, you can get a job basically anywhere, whether that's, in your hometown or if you want to travel to most countries, you can get a job and it'll be really stable. And I think it'll be really, depending on kind of what you want to seek out, it can be incredibly challenging day in, day out, or it can be that you master a craft. I've been really fortunate to work with people who most of my work has been on fabricating and then measuring mirrors, specifically large mirrors for astronomy. And it was really fascinating to talk to some of the people doing this. It's very much so a craft, and they've figured they know, right? And it still blows my mind. They knew if I look at this measurement and it's off by a handful of nanometers, so less than a fraction of a hair, if I rub on it in just this way, literally with my hand in some scenarios, it'll be perfect, and it would be perfect. And that's a craft, right? That's the thing. Speaking from me as a high school boy, where I read about, like, oh, the guy, the craftsman that would make the perfect samurai sword, the same thing. And it still exists. So I think there's a lot of domains in optics and photonics where you can really find a great career. But Anyways, it's again rambling a bit. Well, I've taken up a lot of your time. I guess I'll ask just to close. What advice you have for someone considering the field? I guess really in whatever way they want to approach it, if it's working in industry, or if it's working in outreach, or as a creative medium.
I learnt a great deal and have benefited a great deal from being a member of the professional societies, or, well, for me, it's SPIE, but there's OSA, sorry, Optica now.
Yeah, right, they rebranded.
So that is a good way of a good entry point, I think, if you don't know anything about it, or you're interested in a change of direction. If you're a young person, then I mean, I just begged, borrowed, and stealed. Well, I didn't steal equipment. I just begged and borrowed equipment and asked for people's help and time. And everybody was very, very generous because they value young people coming up in a career. So I would say, yeah, for the older person interested in optics, photonics, have a look at the professional societies. And there's probably Institute of Physics here in the UK, and equivalent in America as well. And holography kits, you know, optics kits, holography kits, making your own stuff in your own space. And thankfully, there are wonderful Facebook forums, fora, for every area of interest, where you can chat to other people and learn from them and get involved that way. I think one thing that I haven't said is that there are huge barriers to getting into optics and photonics for people of color, and I don't want to say people of color and women, because there's an intersection there, but you know, we need to continue to work to break down those barriers. And I've talked at great length in other places about this, but always continue to do so. But making sure that there are ways in which you know, everybody has access to either resources, education through schools, is pretty important. Mm-hmm. So we've got such a shortage of people in working in these fields, and so many jobs, and yet we're preventing lots of people from getting involved. That's the next phase, is to really put an emphasis on how are we putting up barriers for people getting involved in optics and photonics.
Mm-hmm. And how to remove them, hopefully. So I lied. I have one more question after that. Yeah, I apologize.
I'm enjoying talking to you.
My last question is, what do you have, whether it's specific artists or pieces of artwork, or just general recommendations, do you have advice on you know, what people should explore? And I'm gonna share mine very briefly, because I finally found the photographer I was referencing, but her name's Julia Margaret Cameron.
Yeah.
And I'll provide a link to that. And then recently, my wife and I discovered Jessica Todd Harper, and she does similar, well, not similar in the least, actually. She's a modern photographer, but she captures family portraits, without going into too much detail, in a way that's very reminiscent of paintings. And again, it was something for me that really captured my attention. But I'm really curious, from someone who has actually studied and is steeped in the field, what you recommend for people who otherwise haven't really dove in.
Well, I would recommend having a look at the Holo Centre. That's the Centre for Holographic Arts. It's a website where they have a collection of holographers. And if you're in the UK, then there is Jonathan Ross has a holography collection, which he is always happy to show people if you get in touch with him. But people who've changed the course of my work have been Margaret Bennion, who was the first artist to work with holography, who was a mentor of mine. Also grateful for the involvement of Martin Richardson, who was my professor at De Montfort. But there's so many people who've inspired me. Paula Dawson, who is Australian artist who built her own working bar and then made massive 2-meter-long holograms of this is a piece called To Absent Friends, where she built the working bar, got all her friends in at the stroke of midnight, kicked them all out of the bar, and you see, she'd hidden mirrors all around this room. So she was going to, I still don't understand how she can be so amazing technically. But you saw cigarette smoke, or the hole, the black hole where the moving cigarette smoke went, and the movement of drinks in the glasses on the table that had, you know, slight movement. So you can see the solid glass and then the three-dimensional black hole where that moving liquid had been, because holograms can't capture movement. Kind of holography couldn't capture movement. So the sheer scale and the vision of her work always amazed me, as did her writing. So much. Yeah, I can get... Ju Yong Lee is a holographer who's worked with family portraits. He's a South Korean artist. I had to keep an eye on him when I was doing my PhD because I was fearful he was going to venture into my PhD research area. It's like amazing to have so much in common with him as a South Korean man. We thought very similarly. Huh. So, yes. Beautiful, inspiring work on the Holo Center website and Jonathan Ross's website.
Mm-hmm. Well, perfect. My guest this week has been Dr. Pearl John. Pearl, thanks so much.
So welcome.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Spotlight Report. As always, we invite you to go to our website, community.eleoptics.com, where you can communicate and discuss this episode of the podcast and find all other episodes of the podcast, as well as other useful information. Thanks. Have a great day.